program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Hello, and welcome to Audio Journal's look at history from all points of the globe, a program that reports on what has happened, so we might consequently find out what could happen. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. I'm Tricia Droney, and for the next hour, we'll explore a variety of topics, including the oldest time capsule in the United States. Also, we'll learn about Boeing 747's final descent. And also, wealthy men and how they made their money in the United States. We'll begin with learning about those wealthy men in an article entitled, How the Richest Men in U.S. History Made Their Money. Their fortunes fueled industries, funded philanthropy, and sparked debates over inequality. This was written on June 18, 2026, and is by Dave Roos of History.com. The United States has long been fertile ground for generating immense personal wealth. It started with the nation's founding, which coincided with the Industrial Revolution, a time of unprecedented technological change and social upheaval. 2026 is the 250th anniversary of the United States, but it's also the 250th anniversary of Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations, says John Steele Gordon, an economic historian and author. Smith argued that a country's wealth comes not from hoarding gold and silver, as many people believed at the time, but from productive labor, trade, and economic growth. The United States could follow Smithian precepts much more easily than more established economies could, says Gordon. We didn't have an aristocracy. We didn't have a merchant class who protected their own interests. So we had a much freer economy. In a time before antitrust laws and financial regulations, American business was a winner-take-all competition with few rules or restrictions. The richest men in American history, yes, they were all men, were single-minded capitalists who saw the potential of new technologies to disrupt and reshape entire industries. Through brilliant and often devious means, they became the world's first millionaires, billionaires, and now trillionaires. Here's how America's richest people made their money and how their fortune shaped the nation's history for better or worse. Note, because wealth from the 19th and early 20th centuries is difficult to convert accurately into modern dollars, each individual's fortune is also listed as a share of the gross national product, the GNP, at the time, based on special calculations from two notable economists. Our first millionaire was John Jacob Astor, $20 million in 1848. The share of the GNP is 1 out of 107. Born in Germany in 1763, 20-year-old John Jacob Astor emigrated to the United States right after the Revolutionary War. After stints as a butcher, baker, and musical instrument salesman in New York, Astor found his calling in the fur trade. Astor sourced pelts from Native Americans and frontier trappers and built his first fortune exporting furs to Europe and China. When British and Canadian fur companies muscled into some of Astor's territories in the Western frontier, he successfully lobbied Congress to bar foreign-owned fur trading companies from operating in U.S. territories, leaving Astor with a near monopoly of the lucrative fur trade. Having the government on your side is very helpful for an entrepreneur, and it's funny how politicians always seem to find money useful, says Gordon, author of An Empire of Wealth, The Epic History of American Economic Power. So there's some mutual back scratching. Flush with cash from his fur business, Astor pivoted to real estate in the early 1800s. When former Vice President and Aaron Burr faced financial ruin after his arrest on treason charges, Astor purchased Burr's large Manhattan land holdings at bargain prices. Over the next decades, as New York City grew at an exponential rate, Astor gobbled up huge swaths of Manhattan to build an unrivaled real estate dynasty. In the process, Astor became America's first multimillionaire. The Astor name was synonymous with outrageous wealth, and John Jacob's heirs ruled New York society for a century. But when Astor died in 1848, he set a precedent by donating hefty sums of money to charity, including $400,000, considered a small fortune, to build a free public library in Manhattan. His bequest eventually led to the creation of the New York Public Library. The idea that people who flourish abundantly in the American economy are expected to make major philanthropic gifts, that's not a tradition in any other country in the world, Gordon says. Our second person is Jay Gould, worth $77 million in 1892. Share of the GNP is 1 out of 185. Known as the Mephistopheles of Wall Street, Jay Gould made the most of the lawlessness that pervaded Gilded Age financial markets. Over his colorful career, he engaged in countless dirty tricks to outflank the competition, sometimes his fellow investors, and walk away with a pile of cash. Jay Gould was a speculator, Gordon says. He was less interested in running things than he was in manipulating stocks and bonds on Wall Street. In 1868, Gould famously clashed with Cornelius Vanderbilt over control of the Erie Railroad. The two multimillionaires sparred in the New York courts, paying corrupt judges to give them controlling interests in the valuable railway. Gould ultimately won by issuing thousands of shares of watered-down stock, but he cost honest Erie Railroad investors millions in the process. Gould was not one of my top 10 favorite super-rich guys by a long shot, Gordon says. Among Gould's other ploys was an attempt to corner the gold market in 1869. He and his associate Jim Fisk quietly bought up large amounts of gold and nearly got away with it. The U.S. government blocked the hostile bid by releasing $5 million of gold from the Treasury, which triggered a gold panic known as Black Friday. Again, hordes of regular investors were ruined, while gold, tipped off to the government's plans, walked away with millions. When Gould died of tuberculosis in 1892, his fortune was estimated at roughly $72 million to $77 million and was left almost entirely to his family. Some sources estimate that Gould's true wealth may have been substantially higher, with estimates reaching as much as $175 million, though such figures are difficult to verify. And our third wealthy man is John D. Rockefeller, $1.4 billion in 1937. Share of the GNP is 1 out of 65. John D. Rockefeller, a co-founder of the Standard Oil Company, became America's first billionaire and the richest man in American history until Elon Musk took the title in 2026. Rockefeller entered the oil businesses in 1860s when oil prices were volatile and American oil refineries were dangerous, ramshackle operations. Together with his brother William and partners Samuel Andrews and Henry Flager, Rockefeller built state-of-the-art refineries in Cleveland and bought dozens more. In 1870, Rockefeller and his partners incorporated Standard Oil. Within a decade, the hungry new company controlled roughly 80% to 90% of U.S. oil refining capacity. Standard Oil grew so quickly by swallowing up the competition. Rockefeller engineered these buyouts by signing secret deals with the railroads. As the biggest oil producer, Standard Oil could demand rebates from the railroads while ordering them to charge exorbitant rates to Standard Oil's competitors. Most oil companies had no choice but to accept Rockefeller's buyout offers, which Gordon says were generous and often included Standard Oil stock. In 1911, the Supreme Court ruled that Standard Oil was an illegal monopoly and ordered that the company be broken up into more than 30 new entities. Rockefeller didn't suffer. As a major shareholder in those new companies, he ended up twice as rich as before the decision. But the breakup of Standard Oil signals an end to the unregulated business environment that minted so many Gilded Age millionaires while creating vast income inequality in the U.S. All of those people, like Carnegie and Rockefeller, they often showed what laws needed to be passed, says Gordon, citing the Sherman Antitrust Act and the Wagner Labor Act. We had to invent the rules after the game was already played. By the time Rockefeller died in 1937, at 97 years old, he had given away almost $500 million, but he was still by far the richest man America had ever seen. Our next article was written June 12th, 2026, and is in the Atlantic magazine, entitled, "The Boeing 747 Begins Its Final Descent." The jet was perhaps the pinnacle of American engineering excellence. Its retirement signals an end to an era of American culture and ambition. This was written by Ian Bogost, again, of the Atlantic magazine. Through the heat maze, airplane tails rose from the desert. As I steered off the interstate toward Pinal Airport in Marana, Arizona, I got my first view of a corpse in full, a stark white Boeing 747, its wings sheared off, its passenger doors open to the dust and wind, a rickety set of air stairs inviting no one aboard. The plane was a memory, a ruin, but its swooping, humped nose was still striking, a visage that signaled the freedom of movement in the jet age. I was arriving at this desolate site north of Tucson, where airplanes go to die, to mourn the 747, the original jumbo jet, also known as the Whale, the Long Reach, the Skies Cruiser, the mother of all airliners, the queen of the skies. For 50 years, the aircraft was the principal host of important journeys, a young student's trip to study abroad in Paris, a first-generation American's pilgrimage to their ancestral home in Hungary, an Iranian family fleeing the 1979 revolution. Combining the immensity of an ocean liner and the elegance of a swan, the 747 is the only commercial jet that deserves to be called beautiful. Over the past two decades, airlines have stopped using it as a passenger plane and replaced it with smaller aircraft that are more efficient, but far less majestic and memorable. The 747 was once a symbol of American might, invention, progress, and populism. Now it embodies the decline of all of those values. Jim Petty, the air park's manager, led me out of the back door of his small office to his truck, and we peeled out toward the long rows of forsaken aircraft. I had been calling Pinal a boneyard, but Petty told me that he doesn't like the term. Some planes get brought here for a checkup, others for intensive care or storage. Some ailing vessels are delivered here with every intention of flying again, like an elderly relative sent to a short-term care facility. But if rehabilitation proves impossible, Pinal becomes their final destination. Petty parked us under a TWA 747 that had been sitting there for almost 30 years. Its enormity eclipsed the hot desert sun. The tires alone were more than 4 feet tall, a memorial to outsized ambitions. From 1970, when the first 747 entered service, to 2023, when Boeing stopped building the plane, the company manufactured 1,574 of them, including the two that still serve as Air Force One. Most 747 routes spanned oceans and continents, giving travelers a speedier option than the Queen Mary had across the Atlantic, or the California Zephyr across the West. For generations, these jumbo jets flew to London, to Osaka, to San Francisco. But more recently, 747s had been flying to penal, drawn here by their own obsolescence. Someday, Petty said, there's just going to be one left. Starting the engines brings a sudden hush followed by a smooth roar. At 300-some metric tons, fully loaded, and with a wingspan that would cover two-thirds of a football field, the plane could be tricky to drive but was supple to fly. On the ground and about three stories up, pilots were aware of all they couldn't see. Once airborne, though, a sense of infinity dawned out the cockpit windows and of sheer mass behind the pilots. In the cabin, the heft made the plane feel almost still. Even at 500 miles an hour and 35,000 feet, it is the only plane I have ever flown in whose takeoff and landing were imperceptible to the senses. Paul Gallagher, a longtime 747 captain, told me he couldn't remember a hard landing. He said that it was the plane every pilot wanted to fly, the top rung of a commercial aviation career. Like most technological innovations of the 20th century, the 747 project was catalyzed by the military. In the early 1960s, Boeing produced designs in response to a government request for a large military transport aircraft. Lockheed won that job and produced the C-5 Galaxy. Boeing's loss steeled its resolve and freed up engineers to work on the biggest airplane ever built for commercial service. Boeing acquired 780 acres of land in Everett, Washington, just north of Seattle, and erected an assembly complex that included the largest building in the world by volume at a cost of $200 million, which would be $2 billion in today's dollars, to house up to 8 747s under construction. About 2,700 engineers labored on the project. Aviation executives called a risk like this the sporty game, a shameless mid-century flannel suit euphemism for staking an entire company on a single long-odds bet. Had the 747 project faltered, Boeing would likely have gone down with it. Thomas Gray, who joined Boeing in 1961 as an electrical engineer, calls himself the first passenger on the first 747, responsible for in-flight testing. Whether it was stain, arrows, airspeed, whatever, he told me, we had to measure all that data onto a tape machine. Gray, a lanky man with a gray mustache, volunteers as a docent at the Museum of Flight in Seattle, just across from Boeing Field. For 17 years, the 747 served as his office. This was the Wild West of commercial aviation, after planes had been proven, but when the jet age was still new and exciting. Watching the plane's first flight from the blast fence in 1969, Gray remembers telling a fellow engineer beside him, "One of these days, there are going to be 747s lined up to take off." He was right. Boeing's earlier jets, the 707, 727, and 737, carried fewer than 200 souls. The 747 could carry north of 490 passengers, plus a massive amount of cargo, and still fly thousands of miles farther than most existing jets. Juan Tripp, who ordered 25 747s for Pan Am in 1966 at a cost of $5 billion in today's dollars, saw the planes as an instrument of human flourishing. The new era of mass travel between nations may well prove more significant to human destiny than the atom bomb, he said at the time, calling the aircraft a great weapon for peace. The jumbo jet would make the world smaller in the same way that railroads and ocean liners had in the century prior. This was the age of seemingly impossible endeavors undertaken and accomplished despite extreme risk. 5 months after the 747 first took flight, Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon. This spirit of rarefied American invention, fueled by both government investment and private capital, was meant to serve all mankind. It worked. From 1969 to 1979, the number of people flying every year more than doubled. to 640 million. Flying was glamorous, in part because it was expensive, but also because the 747 was built for human comfort as well as fuel efficiency. Speed was expected to supplant comfort eventually. In anticipation of supersonic flight, the 747 was designed to shift into cargo duties sometime by the end of the 70s. Its Cygene hump allowed containers to be loaded through its nose, which opens like the mouth of a cartoon shark. But the supersonic passenger jet was a bust, and the 747 persisted. Its accidental longevity defined an era. The British architect Norman Foster once called the 747 his favorite building of the 20th century. Like the ocean liners and rail cars it replaced, the 747 is more than a vehicle. It is also a dwelling. The upper deck lounge became the first and most important room in this building, though somewhat incidentally. The charge to make the plane capable of loading cargo through its nose required the flight deck to be situated above the main section. Once the flight deck was placed high over the cargo slot, the plane needed to sweep back accordingly for aerodynamics, one retired Boeing engineer told me. What to put in that space? A cocktail bar, obviously. Air France and United installed lounges with rotating seats to allow passengers to mingle. Air India put in bright red carpeting and sofas with images of apsaras on the bulkhead behind them. Qantas offered the nautical-themed Captain Cook Lounge with lantern sconces, intricate woodwork, and rope-wrapped swivel seats and cocktail tables. Boeing named its first 747 the City of Everett after its birthplace, and painted it in Boeing's corporate color scheme, white with a red cheat line, a gray belly, and a black glare panel. Gray and his colleagues used the City of Everett for testing. It was never outfitted with an interior. The aircraft now lives at the Museum of Flight. Visitors can take a tour inside, but are generally not allowed up the spiral staircase to the upper deck and cockpit. I negotiated an exception. When I ascended the tight stairwell, I was surprised to see it decorated as a lounge, complete with antique mirrors on the rear bulkhead, blue carpeting, and vivid mod-printed seating. At some point in the City of Everett's long life, an upholstery shop had redone the upper deck seating with old Braniff Airways fabric. Peggy Berger and Cheryl Grimm, two former United flight attendants, met me in the lounge to share memories of service on early 747s. For Verger, luxury wasn't really the point of the plane's interior design. "We've lost the personality of flying," she said. At first I thought she was talking about the style, the Pucci-designed Braniff uniforms or Aero Saarinen's modernist terminals. But she meant personalities. She meant people. "We loved talking to the people," Verger said. "The lounges, the wide aisles. We were tight with the passengers. So how's your dog?" We were much more social. Travelers turned in their seats to their neighbors. They stood up and chatted with someone across the aisle. They moved through the cabin to a lounge or to ask for a coffee. Sometimes after giving children pin-on airline wings, the stewardesses, as they were called at the time, would recruit them to help pass out nuts or matches. "It was all just so different," Verger added. "The passenger was a person." The food in first class was rich, hand-carved meats, lobster, caviar. Even flyers in the back ate like royalty. On a 1970 Pan Am flight from JFK to Heathrow, a coach-class passenger would have enjoyed filet mignon. Small sofa lounges were tucked into the front or rear of some aircraft. One Continental Airlines 747, called the Proud Bird of the Pacific, had a spacious Polynesian pub in the coach cabin with floral print seats around low-slung pedestal tables. American Airlines built a coach lounge with black and white geometric carpet and red upholstered seating that anyone might mistake for a hotel lobby. American installed a piano bar there too, although it used an electric organ. Pianos are hard to keep in tune when subjected to the forces of takeoff and landing. Features like these inspired Continental in 1971 to advertise its 747 flights as air cruises. Grimm recalled constant activities and contests. Passengers celebrating a birthday or an anniversary could order a cake or a bottle of champagne. It was just a nice party, she said. The cabin ceilings rose to 8 feet, even at the window seats, and the exterior walls stood nearly straight up and down, allowing even the tallest passengers to stand upright, like a human instead of a sardine. Use of the whole space was encouraged. Why make a building for people to remain seated in? A TWA pamphlet about 747 service from the early 1970s encouraged passengers to exercise on their flight. Walk 13 times up and down the cabin and you've actually covered 1 mile. Continental once boasted of removing 41 seats for 4 extra inches of legroom in coach. Even on a 3-hour domestic flight, the experience of the airborne building was deemed as important as the transportation itself. Wide-body airliners made global flight accessible to many people, but industry growth slowed by the mid-1970s. The 1973 oil shock made fuel more expensive, altering the fundamentals of the airline business. Hijacking surged, leading to the invention of airport security. In 1978, deregulation transformed the economics of the domestic airline industry. Fares dropped dramatically and more people began to fly. As the clientele became more pedestrian, flying felt less cosmopolitan. And the comfort started to vanish. The social spaces and coach lounges began disappearing so the airlines could cram in more passengers, including into the upper deck, which became certified for passenger seating during taxi, takeoff, and landing. The new hub-and-spoke model of air service started displacing milk-run paths. Domestic flights on the 747, such as the Chicago to L.A. leg of the proud bird of the Pacific, became rarer. Instead, the aircraft mostly flew people over oceans. The most beautiful building of the 20th century was becoming just another vehicle. Before the September 11 attacks closed terminals to the unticketed, anyone could pass through the metal detectors and go right up to the gate. You could do this to welcome or send off a loved one. You could meet up with a friend on a layover, or you could just see the planes. Cheryl Grimm remembers passengers bringing their friends to the gate just to see her 747 taxiing. Pilots remember it too. Mark Van Hokener flew 747s for British Airways out of London until 2019, just before the airline removed the plane from service. He told me about disembarking at his favorite destinations, Cape Town, Tokyo, Vancouver, and looking over his shoulder in childlike wonder. "I can't believe I flew that airplane a third of the way around the world," he'd think to himself. The aircraft began service in the middle of the Vietnam War. In 1975, after the tragic crash of a C-5 Galaxy military transport aircraft meant to evacuate Vietnamese orphans, two chartered Pan Am 747s stepped in as part of Operation Baby Lift. That effort was accused of both propagandism and abduction, but many citizens were desperate to leave Vietnam, and they did so voluntarily in the bosom of the mother of all airliners. For that reason, Peggy Verger understood crewing the 747 as a patriotic act. She remembered a group of Vietnamese refugees boarding a flight of hers in Tokyo, and when they got off, they were doctors and lawyers, and a lot of them spoke English. They would say things like, "Thank you for letting me come into your country," she said, stopping to press her heart, tears coming down. Grimm remembers similar scenes on flights to Vancouver before Hong Kong reverted to Chinese rule. Or Russian immigrants on flights to New York, a whole family, from the grandmother to the children, taking up an entire row of the airplane, each with just a little sack of belongings. Grimm would think to herself, "Thank you, Lord, for letting me be born in America." The 747's fusion of aeronautical ability and symbolic power earned it many roles beyond passenger liner and freighter. By 1977, Thomas Gray, the Boeing engineer, was running test flights for a heavily modified Whale to carry the space shuttle Enterprise atop it. NASA used the plane to shuttle the shuttle from its landing sites back to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. One icon of America had settled the global skies, and on its shoulders sat another, set to conquer the cosmos. The sight of the pair mated together suggested that the 20th century's progress would never end. It did, of course. The shuttle program closed in 2011 as 747s were already disappearing from the skies. Today, beholding a 747 in person has become harder, especially in the United States. The charter carrier Atlas Air flies some, as does the freight operator Kalita. But even their numbers are dwindling as companies move to more efficient two-engine aircraft. Lufthansa flies the most scheduled passenger flights on the 747, between Frankfurt and destinations that include Chicago, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. And Korean Air also still runs the plane overseas. But the 747 has moved down market. China, Iran, and Russia use them for bus-like domestic routes. Even when foreign carriers fly 747s, though, the sight of one of those planes invokes American ingenuity because the aircraft was designed and built by America. When the 747 is gone, other aircraft will service high-capacity long-haul routes. The Boeing 777, for example, and the Airbus A350. But none of those planes will symbolize global access and renewal because nothing about any other plane is symbolic. They all look and feel the same. They are just metal tubes with wings. When we are on a plane these days, we are really inside our headphones, sewn into our seats, yearning for it to end. The miracle of flight itself goes unnoticed, as even daytime travelers draw their shades. They do so to sleep or to increase the contrast on their screen. Striking up a conversation is taboo. 6 miles above ground, you feel buried rather than aloft. The last 747 on Americans' radar is the one carrying Donald Trump. Air Force One has been a 747 for nearly 36 years, since George H.W. Bush first ascended its staircase on September 6, 1990, to fly from Andrews Air Force Base to Topeka, Kansas, for a fundraising luncheon. Air Force One is heavily modified and highly customized. Its 4,000 square feet of interior space include a medical facility and two kitchens that can serve 100 gourmet meals. But from the outside, it still looks the same way as any other 747, from Pan Am onward, apart from the color scheme and presidential seal. In previous eras, the most powerful person in the world boarded the same equipment that you might use to take a Hawaiian vacation. But there was something regal about a president descending those steps or waving from top of them on foreign soil. The plane is a literal ship of state. On September 11, 2001, amid a nationwide ground stop while the country was under attack, Air Force One was George W. Bush's flying Oval Office, to borrow Boeing's phrase. Trump loves to do domestic flyovers of his rallies, of a Washington Commanders game in November, and show off the sheer size of the plane at low altitudes. But Air Force One has aged. The two 747s that currently share the duty are the same ones that Bush 41 flew on. In 2018, the first Trump administration struck a $3.9 billion deal with Boeing to make two new planes, based on the 747-8, the aircraft's final variation. The planes were meant to be delivered by 2024, but they have not arrived. The project has been plagued by technical issues, supplier disputes, and alleged tomfoolery, empty mini tequila bottles were reportedly discovered on one of the airplanes under construction. Boeing has absorbed more than $2 billion in cost overruns on the project. We continue to make steady progress on the project, a Boeing spokesman told me. The stumble couldn't have come at a worse moment for the company. Around the same time that Trump ordered the new Air Force Ones, Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft began experiencing software problems that eventually led to disaster, including two accidents that killed 346 people. All planes in the fleet were grounded. Boeing paid large penalties and settlements in the ensuing years and faced increased competition from Airbus, its European rival. In January 2024, an Alaska Airlines 737 MAX 9 suffered a door plug blowout due to improper installation. The company that once played the sporty game to invent the jumbo jet couldn't seem to make new versions of its bread-and-butter mid-range aircraft. By spring 2025, still without his Air Force One, Trump began to consider accepting a luxury-appointed Boeing 747-8 as a gift from Qatar instead. Despite concerns about corruption and national security, the government took the gift, valued at $400 million. Only a, quote, stupid person would decline a, quote, free, very expensive airplane, Trump said at the time. The cost of modifying the plane for presidential use is classified. Probably less than $400 million is what Air Force Secretary Troy Mink told Congress last year. The Air Force announced on May 1, 2026, that the aircraft is scheduled to fly this summer with a new red, white, and blue livery. Will the American taxpayer end up paying for both the retrofitting and the new planes? Yes, an Air Force spokesman told me. Another problem plagues a presidential 747, whether or not an emir delivers it. It is not a plane of the people anymore. It is a rarity, more often an opulent private palace than an instrument of common carriage. The likeliest way for me to fly on a 747 in the United States at this moment would be in a press seat on the president's plane. A common route for Air Force One these days is from Andrews Air Force Base to Palm Beach International Airport for Trump's weekends at Mar-a-Lago. I figured that the White House and even the president himself might welcome me aboard to experience the greatest passenger plane in the sky over the greatest country in the world. The White House nearly gave me a seat in late January, but then the trip filled up. On one of the flights I was not aboard that weekend, Trump told reporters that he had opened airspace in South America so that some immigrants could, quote, go back to Venezuela and stay, perhaps. America has traveled a long way from Peggy Verger's huddled masses yearning to fly free. In recent years, the 747 has amounted to an old plane for an old man president. What will its next iteration symbolize? If a new Air Force One finally rolls off the beleaguered Boeing line, it will still be a fully American Lodestar, however faded its shine. If instead Trump flies on a gift from a foreign power, it won't matter how American its bones are. Flying is more a part of life than ever, but it feels disappointing at best and inhumane at worst. This year, a Homeland Security shutdown created hours-long security lines. An elective war with Iran spiked the cost of fuel and ticket prices. Old dreams were forgotten, too. The possibility of supersonic passenger travel has been abandoned in favor of trim tab adjustments, such as Boeing's 787 Dreamliner, with its bigger windows and less arid cabins. The competition that deregulation once spurred has all but dried up. The few airlines that are left, having been allowed to consolidate into oligopoly, have abandoned the medium-sized cities that were their former hubs, such as Cincinnati, St. Louis, Pittsburgh, and Memphis. The big four U.S. carriers, United, Delta, American, and Southwest, have effectively become banks. The difference between profit and loss comes down to the loyalty points they sell to their credit card partners each year. Cramped passengers are ruled not by bonhomie, but by hair trigger aggression, while flight crews seek compliance rather than kinship. No frills are left to entice or distract passengers. The main benefit of sitting in first class is that you might still be served free cocktails, while a coach passenger is left with a puny bag of carbs, one cup of soda, and complimentary, for now, trash collection. Forget about power and freedom. Commercial airplanes no longer symbolize anything except a desire to be anywhere else. Nobody cares what kind of plane they fly in anymore, so long as they are on it as little as possible. A quarter of the 21st century has now elapsed, but the 20th century, its engines cut, has managed to stay aloft. It is now finally landing at Pinal Air Park in Arizona. I flew the last passenger U.S. airplane to the desert, Captain Steve Hanlon told me by phone from Atlanta, where he works for Delta as a flight simulator pilot instructor. In 2017, Delta retired the aircraft and the rest of its 747 fleet for the same reason every other airline did and will. A four-engine jumbo jet is more expensive to operate than newer, if less striking, alternatives. This last carrier went on a farewell tour of former Northwest and Delta hubs, including hangar parties in Seattle, Detroit, Atlanta, and Minneapolis, and a more somber affair in L.A. "Don't say it's sad," Hanlon remembers the Delta corporate reps telling him. They also changed how he referred to the vessel. "She," as sailors have done since antiquity, in an interview for a corporate press release, "say instead they put it," he said, scoffing. The scene aboard the ship 6314, which was the name of the last flight, was celebratory. A pilot and a flight attendant who had met on a 747 military charter years earlier were married in the air. But Hanlon, who had been flying 747s for 20 years, felt the pull of an ending as he held the whale's yoke, setting the aircraft down gently on the Pinal runway with his co-captain Paul Gallagher by his side. "It was sad," Hanlon told me, "like putting my favorite dog down. It was the last time either man would fly a 747. Ship 6314's phantom neighbors include the 747 that once transported the Ohio televangelist Ernest Angley, who used the plane to spread the good word before financial issues brought him back to Earth. Japan's equivalent to Air Force One is also here. So is a 747 that was intended for Saudi Crown Prince Sultan bin Abdul Aziz and cost $300 million. It flew for less than 50 hours and is now being scrapped at Pinal, the aviation equivalent of parting out a brand new Bugatti. When Jim Petty, Pinal's manager, parked us under the long-forsaken TWA 747, he pointed out the grid of missing skin where aluminum from the fuselage had been cut in tidy rows to make plane tags, a type of aviation collectible. Nearby, a former Korean Air vessel's nose cone had been removed clean, as if seared off with a hot knife. A galley intercom phone hung from a chasm in the tail of another 747, swinging as if dropped from a phone booth in a film noir. Just above it, Petty pointed out a hawk roost. "For 5 years they came here," he said. "I always thought it was cool that a bird made its nest in a plane." When all of the useful parts have been claimed from a corpse, industrial scavengers tug the remains to a cement pad, where excavators tear the vessel into bits of metal, Petty explained. The scrap gets loaded onto 18-wheelers and hauled away for recycling. "It's never used again to make an aircraft," he said, "but it goes into wheels for cars or beer cans." Pointing at the Diet Coke he gave me upon arrival to quench my desert thirst, Petty noted that it might once have been a small piece of the Queen of the Skies. Almost all of the engines had been harvested from these planes. Removing the weight can cause the planes to tip upward and point their noses to the sky. The blades of one abandoned engine, lying at Pinal since 2014, issued a tiny clatter as they spun in the breeze. "It makes me think that the plane wants to head out," Petty said. "It wants to go." But both of us knew better. It was a death rattle, and for more than just a type of airplane. In the faux Braniff lounge aboard that first 747 at the Museum of Flight, I had asked Cheryl Grimm and Peggy Verger for their best memory of the aircraft. The former flight attendants couldn't summon a story and instead fell back on a feeling. "You were just happy to be there," Verger said. Grimm could only echo that bygone affection. "You were just happy to be there." Next up, from History.com on June 17th, 2026, written by Dave Roos, "What's Inside the Oldest Known Time Capsule in America?" The oldest known time capsule in the United States was stashed away in 1795 by two of the most famous figures from the American Revolution, Samuel Adams and Paul Revere. After the war, Adams served as governor of Massachusetts and presided over the construction of a new state house in Boston. When the cornerstone was laid on July 4, 1795, the ceremony included burying a copper box containing coins, a medal depicting George Washington, and a commemorative silver plaque engraved by Revere. The priceless cash was first unearthed in 1855 and again in 2014. Both times, new items were added before reburying the capsule. The original time capsule buried by Adams and Revere in 1795 contained 11 coins, each with historic significance to the new nation. The oldest coin was a 1665 Pine Street shilling, the first coin minted in colonial Massachusetts in defiance of the English government. Another coin was a 1787 New Jersey cent, the first American money stamped with the motto E Pluribus Unum. The original time capsule also contained a small commemorative medal bearing an image of Washington, who was president in 1795, and a silver plaque commemorating the laying of the State House cornerstone on the 20th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The plaque bore the names of Adams, Revere, and William Scollay, a Revolutionary War colonel. In 1855, the time capsule was unearthed by workers making emergency repairs to the Massachusetts State House Foundation. Officials added 12 more coins to the copper box, plus pages from five of Boston's leading newspapers and official state documents. The time capsule was resealed in plaster and remained untouched for nearly 160 years. In 2014, an engineering firm was hired to repair water damage to the State House Foundation. Before excavating the site, technicians used ground-penetrating radar to locate the time capsule, whose existence was documented in historical accounts. Conservators took 7 hours to carefully extract the fragile copper box and bring it to the Museum of Fine Arts, where its well-preserved contents were put on display. The 220-year-old time capsule was reburied in 2015 under the State House cornerstone, along with two additional additions, an engraved silver plate, and a full set of 2015 coins from the U.S. Mint. There's been so much excitement in New York City with the Knickerbockers win championship of the NBA this year. So I thought we would take a look at an article entitled, "How Did Knickerbockers Become a Symbol of New York?" This was written by Leslie Kennedy on June 16, 2026. A pair of baggy, knee-length pants might not seem like the stuff of New York legend, but the term Knickerbockers has been part of the city's identity for more than two centuries, from Dutch settlers in old New Amsterdam to championship basketball courts. Knickerbockers are loose trousers, rolled or gathered, just below the knee, worn by Dutch settlers in 18th and early 19th century New York. Washington Irving helped popularize the word in 1809 with the publication of his satire, A History of New York from the Beginning of the World to the End of the Dutch Dynasty, under the pen name Dietrich Knickerbocker. Knickerbocker is one of the most familiar names in America, the Wall Street Journal reported in 2000. For nearly 200 years, the name has been appropriated for its charm and distinctly New York connotations. The newspaper adds that the first Knickerbocker was an alias invented by 17th century New Amsterdam settler Harman Jansen van Wyth. His signature morphed to Knickerbacker, which Irving later tweaked to Knickerbocker. The baggy New Amsterdam knee pants depicted in the book's illustrations became known as Knickerbockers, a term eventually applied to women's underdrawers, the Wall Street Journal reports. By the late 19th century, Knickerbockers shifted from colonial practicality to everyday menswear, especially for sports. Their roomy cut made them ideal for cycling, golf, and hiking. Emily Angus in the Fashion Encyclopedia notes that the style allowed plenty of freedom of movement. Women tried them too. A 1921 Women's Wear Daily article reported the growing trend of Knickerbocker suits, although women's apparel retailers called the idea an absurdity. By the 1930s, long trousers came into vogue, pushing the Knickerbocker trend aside. By the 1830s, Father Knickerbocker, a symbolic figure dressed in a wig, three-cornered hat, buckled shoes, and Knickerbockers, became a New York mascot. A nearly 70-foot Father Knickerbocker balloon appeared in the 1936 Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, while, according to the New York Times, the city's first official Father Knickerbocker toured the world in 1949, drawing stares from Calcutta to Damascus. In Damascus, Arab soldiery and Arab citizenry gaped at his snuff-brown colonial jacket, his four-tiered jabots, and his gold-buckled slippers, and his tight knee breeches, the newspaper reported. The name spread widely. Knickerbocker beer was a top seller for New York's Jacob Rupert & Company Brewery. New York literary magazine The Knickerbocker debuted in 1833. The musical Knickerbocker Holiday, loosely inspired by Irving's story and set in 1647 New Amsterdam, ran on Broadway in 1938. And Charlie Knickerbocker and Susie Knickerbocker were pseudonyms for long-running New York Society columns, with Charlie's byline first appearing in 1891. Sports teams embraced the term early. The Knickerbocker Boat Club launched in 1811. In 1845, Alexander Cartwright's Manhattan Baseball Club became the New York Knickerbockers, one of the first organized baseball teams. A century later, in 1946, when New York received a Basketball Association of America franchise, founder Ned Irish literally pulled the name Knickerbockers from a hat. We each put a name in the hat, and when we pulled them out, most of them said Knickerbockers, after Father Knickerbocker, the symbol of New York City, former Madison Square Garden executive Fred Podesta once said, according to NBA.com. It was soon shortened to Knicks. The original Knicks logo, used until 1964, featured a smiling Father Knickerbocker dribbling a basketball, according to NBA.com. A modernized version resurfaced in 2014 for the Westchester Knicks, New York's G League developmental team. Albany also got in on the act. The Knickerbocker Arena opened in 1990, hosting NBA exhibition games, WWF wrestling matches, and more. It was renamed in 1997. And finally, a brief history from the book from National Geographic called An Uncommon History of Common Things by Bethane Patrick and John Thompson is a short history of the Star-Spangled Banner, the national anthem, written by Francis Scott Key, September 14, 1814, in Baltimore, Maryland. The first title was Defense of Fort M. Henry. Today, we are accustomed to identifying the words, O say can you see by the dawn's early light, as the national anthem of the United States. However, even though the song's lyrics were penned in 1812, It didn't gain that designation until 1931. During the War of 1812, a young Washington lawyer named Francis Scott Key accompanied John Skinner to the British fleet in Chesapeake Bay. It was 1814, and they were trying to get their friend, Dr. William Beanes, released from British custody. Beanes had been captured by the British following the Battle of Bladensburg and the burning of Washington, D.C. Beanes had treated several injured British seamen, and because of this, the British commander agreed to let him go, but only after a planned attack on Fort McHenry in Baltimore's harbor had been carried out. He insisted on keeping Key and Skinner in custody overnight while the attack was waged. The fort was, of course, flying the U.S. flag, and Key watched it until it became too dark, knowing that if the flag came down, the fort would have surrendered. At dawn, when he saw the flag still flying, Francis Scott Key was inspired to write a poem. All he had was the back of an envelope, and he scribbled down Defense of Fort M. Henry, which was first circulated as a handbill and then published in September of 1814 in a Baltimore newspaper. It became popular and was sung to the tune To Anacreon in Heaven, a popular English song. The Star-Spangled Banner was regarded as the national anthem of the United States by the Army and the Navy, but it wasn't official until 1916, when President Woodrow Wilson issued an executive order. In 1931, an act of Congress confirmed it. The Star-Spangled Banner is notoriously difficult to sing, even for professionals, let alone ordinary citizens. To promote better knowledge of the song, the National Anthem Project was begun in 2005 and celebrates National Anthem Project Day each September on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. The project supporters claim it will help music education in schools. You've been listening to All Things History, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call us at 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. This is Tricia Droney, and if you're a history buff, please know we'd love to hear your thoughts and ideas on an interesting topic for us to investigate. Thanks so much for listening today.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
Europeans love the game football, or what we commonly call soccer. The excitement of attending a game often increases dramatically when you're surrounded by the crowd screaming for their favorite teams and players. Not long ago, Coventry, England hosted a soccer tournament. Following the introduction of the players and the singing of the national anthem, an announcement came over the PA asking the crowd to keep the noise to a minimum throughout the game. Why would such a strange request be made?
And here's the solution to our mystery.
The tournament was being played by five teams of blind soccer players. The soccer ball they used was filled with 100 ball bearings. Everyone had to remain quiet so that the players could hear the ball's location.
And now back to our regular programming.